Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Stephen Bird, and he'll be answering your most important questions on fly fishing the Upper Columbia River. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Stephen a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Stephen Bird about fly fishing the Upper Columbia River. Whether fishing for trout in the Rocky Mountains, chasing silver salmon in Alaska, or jumping tarpon in the Florida Keys, the Platte River Fly Shop online store has all the top brands you will need to gear up for your trip. They are Wyoming's largest Sims and Patagonia dealer, keeping a large variety of popular items in stock year-round. You might even find a great deal in their closeout section, from rods and reels to waders and boots. And if you're headed through Wyoming, make sure to put the Blue Ribbon North Platte River Tailwaters on your bucket list. Log on to WyomingFlyFishing.com today and check out their store, or give them a call at 307-237-5997, 307-237-5997, and you can chat with their experienced fly shop staff. Again, that's WyomingFlyFishing.com. Before we introduce Stephen, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we're going to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Stephen's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Stephen's book, Upper Columbia Fly Fisher, courtesy of Amato Books. And to find out more about what Amato Books has to offer, just go to amatobooks.com. They've got plenty of books on fishing, as well as publications and periodicals as well. So here's how you can win Stephen's book. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question will be about something we talked about during the show. So you must submit your answer along with your name and your location in the text box on our homepage. So listen closely, type fast, and make sure the answer is right, and you might win Stephen's book. If you hear me pausing tonight, that's me muting out so that I can clear my throat or cough. I've got an allergy thing going on here that I'm going to have to fight through. So bear with me. Our guest tonight is Stephen Bird. Stephen is a writer, guide, and mentor headquartered on the American Reach of the Columbia River in northeast Washington. Stephen is the author of Upper Columbia Fly Fisher, published by Amato Books Press, and the online Soft Tackle Journal, which is a blog he writes on quite regularly. He has been described as a neoclassicist in his approach to fly design and delivery, and that makes him secretly smile. Steve's office is on the water, and the results of his time there are gathered at his Soft Hackle Journal, which you'll find at soft-hacklejournal.blogspot.com. Stephen, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Hello, Roger. Good to be with you.
Good. Good to have you. And you're down in Southern California at the moment, though, right? Not up in
I am. I have a grandchild's addiction, so I have to spend some time down here in the winter.
I just got that exactly 3 months ago. I had my first grandchild. So
congratulations.
Yeah, I know what that's all about now, finally.
You learn how to raise children once you start having grandchildren.
Yeah.
Well, you go home and you go, oh, man, that was easy.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I was, as he was crying last Friday and they were leaving, I was going, oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
So, anyway, no, it's wonderful. Well, listen, we've got a lot to cover tonight. New topic for me. I've not fished the Upper Columbia or been up in neck of the woods at all, so I know I'm going to learn a lot tonight, and I'm sure everybody online is anxiously waiting for us to get the ball rolling here. There were a lot of questions that came in, and first off is Greg, who's in Western Washington, and he says, I've heard reference to the Upper Columbia before, but it's a big river. When you say the Upper River, are you referring to BC, Washington State, or where do you define the Upper Columbia River? So, Stephen, tell us about your stretch of that Columbia River that you know best and what we'll be talking about tonight.
All right. Well, first of all, Greg, that is a really good question because that's what we're going to be talking about. That does highlight two areas. When you say Upper Columbia, the Canadians laugh at us when we say Upper Columbia because there's another 300 to 350 miles of river in Canada all the way up to its source at Columbia Lake. So when I say Upper Columbia, I mean the Upper American Columbia, our portion of the river right below the Canadian border. Basically, as regards fishing, I'm referring to that portion of the river that runs from the head of Lake Roosevelt at a place called China Bend up to the Canadian border, which is a distance of about 19 miles, and then another 30 miles up to the Arrow Lake at Castlegar, British Columbia, the Hugh Keenly Side Dam, which is another 30 miles. So altogether, we've really only got about a 50-mile stretch of river that's not lacustrine. Now, I think the reason, actually, the Upper Columbia as a fishery, we're an anomaly in this day and age. You don't hear about the Upper Columbia as a blue ribbon trout stream. It's just not listed among, you know, with the Madison and the Yellowstone and all these places that we hear about a lot. But yet, we have world-class trout. 20 years ago, I think it was about 20 years ago, Steve Probasco wrote an article that appeared in Fly Fisherman magazine where he actually stated it was the greatest native trout tailwater fishery in the world. And I haven't fished the whole world myself, so I couldn't say, but that gives you an idea. And one would wonder how in this day and age something like that could go by the boards and not very many people know about it. And there's several reasons for that. One reason is if you look on any map, you will see Lake Roosevelt shown on the map all the way clear to the Canadian border, where in reality is that 19-mile stretch of river that pretty much resembles the original free-flowing river. There's enough gradient there to where there's not as much dam effect, and there's been agreements with the dams over years. Now they release flows to make it approximate pretty much the original river flow there. So we only have about a 19-mile section within the U.S. that's of the main stem itself. However, there's major drainages that are part of that system that come off of Lake Roosevelt. One is the Kettle River system, and the other is the San Poil River system to the south, which both have native populations of red band trout. And those fish are highly migratory within the system, leaving those rivers and entering the main stem, and, you know, they catch them all the way in the main stem, all the way up to Keenly Side Dam in Canada.
Stephen, I'm going to stop you for just a second because I'm trying to orient myself here on the map, and I'm not seeing Roosevelt Lake. Is that created by a dam?
Yes, that's what's backed up behind Grand Coulee Dam.
Oh, way down there. Okay.
Yep. We're talking about that stretch of river between Grand Coulee Dam and the U.S.-Canadian border.
Okay.
Now, 100 miles of that is lacustrine. That will be Lake Roosevelt backed up behind Grand Coulee Dam. Now, of course, Grand Coulee cut off any salmon or steelhead from the ocean, so we get no anadromous fish there.
Okay. And you fished that whole section from the Roosevelt Lake all the way up to the border and past, basically. All that is quality water. Okay.
Well,
all right.
Not all of it's quality water. There's a lot of water there. But, like, if you fish in the arm, in the sandpoil arm, in the kettle arm, and in the kettle, and actually in the sandpoil arm, and in the main stem above China Bend at the head of Lake Roosevelt, you can probably find that on the map, China Bend as well. It's several miles downstream of Northport, Washington. Or we could say, for the sake of the map, between Northport, Washington, and the Canadian border, which would be prime section, actually the section that I guide on.
Yeah.
So that puts us in the extreme northeastern corner of Washington State.
Yeah, I found Northport there. So from Northport north is the area that you're most familiar with and fish most often?
That's right.
Okay. Good. Yeah, I see that. Northport's right on the river, in fact, right? Yeah.
Right. So a lot of people don't know that river section exists there because it shows it as Lake Roosevelt on the map all the way to the border.
And
now if you look at some of the older maps, the older fur trade maps were very accurate and actually showed that section of river. They actually named it the American Reach. And we still call it the American Reach. So when I refer to the American Reach, I'm referring to that section between China Bend at the head of Lake Roosevelt and the Canadian border. And then north of the border, the other 30-mile segment would be the Canadian Reach, which stretches from the border to Hugh Keenly-Side Dam at Castle Gar, British Columbia. That's right at the confluence of the Kootenai River.
Okay.
So that section, even though it's very truncated, it holds quite a bit of water. It picks up the water of the Pend d'Oreille right above the border with Canada, doubles in size there. So it's quite different in character north and south of the border. South of the border, it's doubled in size. So the Pend d'Oreille enters right at the border. And once you get above the Pend d'Oreille, the river is, I would compare it to the Deschutes or the Yellowstone in size.
Okay.
Quite a bit different in character.
Okay. So we've got a big, wide, probably pretty deep river all through there, right?
That's an average of 30 feet deep, up to a quarter of a mile wide, the average surface speed of 6 knots on the American side.
Okay. We had another question from Mike Clark in New York, and he says he goes out to Oregon to visit family and fishes in Columbia, I guess from Oregon down south. And he said, can you direct me to where to go, trout, salmon, or steelheading, where access on foot is possible? So you already told us that there's no steelhead or salmon up in this stretch, right?
Right.
And is the section you're talking about, is
I think I can answer his question, though, as regarding the Columbia River.
Okay.
I think that's a pretty good question, Mike, because a lot of people would want to know that, and a lot of people do ask that. And I can tell you that the entire Columbia River within the United States is public property to the high water mark. It's a navigable waterway.
Okay.
And quite a bit of it is fronted by state land and railroad property, which, they don't mind people going across, and it's not fenced. You can cross that. So actually, it's pretty easy access along the entire length of the Columbia River. If you want to bank fish it, you can. It's public property, the high water mark, anywhere you go. The section I fish is pretty easy access, really. It can be spotty depending on season, but it's not hard to access, and you can hike up or down the banks. Like I say, and not worry about private property if you stay below the high water mark, which is actually pretty ample there. So access is not really a problem. It's kind of hard for me to tell you where to go because, that's going to change. That's going to be a variable that's going to change daily. We get into the rest of the night talking about where to go at what time of the year.
Well, it looks as though there's the road that just really follows the river up, so there's a lot of possibilities, it looks like.
That's right. That's right.
Northport, yeah. How much does the river volume change during the year, or during the fishing season, I should say? stay pretty...
Well, it changes considerably, actually. I don't have the figures in front of me, actually, the flow chart, but it's quite low. Right now, it's low. It's low through the winter. Like I say, it pretty much follows the natural seasons, and it's low. It's high through the spring up until now. It's not like in the Rocky Mountain region where you have extremely high water late into the summer. We usually have, the spate usually goes by, it's usually gone by us by the 4th of July, and it's starting to clear up pretty good then. And then low water, maximum low water would be March at the end of winter. And but actually, the water level doesn't really affect the fishing good or bad. It affects where the fish concentrate.
Right.
However,
right.
It doesn't really affect the fishing itself.
We have a question came in on the Internet here from Larry Hall, Indian River, Michigan. And he says, be sure to talk about the weightability of the Columbia for those anglers that like to go it alone. So we can get down. Is there really much wading to be done with the, I mean, are there shoals?
Right. That's a good question. No, there's not a lot of wading. It drops the entire segment that I'm talking. Now, on the Canadian side, it's a different story.
Right.
Now, on the Canadian side, you've got half the water. You have more, less gradient. So you have more bars there, gravel bars, that type of structure where you can wade, you know, where it's shallow, you know, it doesn't drop off real deep real quickly. There's a lot of that kind of water, you know, and of course one would want to, you could bank fish it and you would definitely want to wear waders there. Whereas on the American side, there's not even any need to wear waders at all because you don't even want to go in the water. It drops off very quickly. The bottom is composed mainly of skull-sized loose stones. They're round, you know, polished from the glacier flows and stuff, very loose, very slippery under the water with algae growth on it. It's like wading on ball bearings. There's no need to anyway. Like I say, it drops off very quickly, and when we fish the bank, we just walk high and dry. I mean, we just fish in sandals or wading shoes, and just everything's pretty reachable from the bank, really. Like I say, it drops off so quickly that you can just pretty much pull your cast out and swing it on down. You know, distance isn't really a factor there. It's not like you have to wade out to them.
Right, right.
No, I would say you really want to avoid, there's really, if you saw it, you would see on the American Reach segment, there's really nothing that's really wadeable, really.
Okay, so sounds like the best access is with a boat. And
well, no, not really. Actually, I wouldn't advise taking a boat there unless one was familiar with the river. There is some hazards there, and there's shallow bars mid-river, and there's places that need to be avoided that you need to know about. I would suggest anybody that was really interested to go there with a local. If you're interested in taking your boat, take a ride with somebody first and learn where the channel is.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
As far as the bank goes, it's very good fishing from the bank. Really, I prefer fishing it from the bank because one of the problems with fishing in a boat with a 6-knot current is if you don't have a guy to hold the boat for you with the oars, you're just going to be ripping along fishing fast and it's not a very relaxed pace to fish at. Whereas you can swing from the bank and just walk right on down the bank, vacuuming along as you go and cast over plenty of fish. There's fish all through the river, like I say, the structure all the way across it. However, the majority of the fish are concentrated within a cast of the bank. So, no, I wouldn't say it requires a boat. I would say if a person wanted to meet it, actually fairly hassle-free, the best way to meet it would be to fish it from the bank, actually.
Okay, good. Good. Yeah, I just kind of figured that might be the case, but there again, I'm wrong again. Let me see here. Oh, Bruce asked about access as well, which you've already addressed, Bruce from San Diego. But he also asked about up in British Columbia, what are their laws about river access up there, and private versus public?
Right. You know, I'm really not sure, Bruce, on the public access to the high water mark there, but I can tell you, though I do fish the Canadian side, no problem. there's not a lot of development along the banks up there, or and it's not fenced. And when I see no fence and no sign, I just go and fish. And, you know, if somebody says anything, I politely apologize and leave. And I've never had that happen. And I run into a lot of other guys fishing up there, too. And I've never asked about access there, but it seems like everywhere you go, just people fishing on the bank. And like I said, there's not a lot of development there along the bank. And in fact, up in, well, downtown Castlegar, right at the confluence of the Kootenai right there, you can fish all around there and through the town. The town has a wonderful park all along the river there on both sides, and sometimes during the sedge hatch there in the early summer, it's just some of the most incredible fishing you ever want to see, and you're right there in town, and they actually promote it, and I've never, you know, had anybody stop it from accessing anywhere up there.
Well,
so, no, not a big problem, really. You see open water, no fence, and, you know, it's wild country, and it's not very developed. If you're used to California and places like that, you'll find that it's really a different world, really.
Yeah. Well, Stephen, I got to take a quick break, and we'll be right back and talk more about the Upper Columbia, so stick with us. Housatonic River Outfitters offers the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with their guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, they offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing trips for warm water species. Please tour their website at www.dryflies.com to view the fishing products and guide services they offer in Connecticut and Massachusetts. They were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services and have the largest established guide services in New England. To learn more about the Housatonic River Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com. That's www.dryflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Stephen Bird about fly fishing the Upper Columbia River. If you'd like to ask Stephen a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com. And use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Stephen, at this point in the show, I always ask my guests, you know, what's going on in your fly fishing world. So tell us a little bit about your business and your blog and your any other writing you've got going on. Tell us what's happening.
Well, right now I'm involved with a group up on the river. We call ourselves the Upper Columbia Native Fish Alliance, and we're basically just a loose group of bloggers and people who like to fish the river that would like to bring it to the attention to the people who need to know what needs to be done there. For a long time, we basically last year, we finally got them to put a take the limit off of walleye. Walleye were illegally introduced into Lake Roosevelt in 1959, and the latest survey, the biologist, we were really having a problem with them eating up all our native trout, and the biologist did a survey, and three surveys showed that the walleyes are eating 50 to 70% of the native fish spawned in the river before they reached maturity. So we really had to fight long and hard to get the limit lifted on them, and we were finally able to do that a couple years ago. So we think we're starting to see actually some positive results from that already. But now the treaty, the most recent thing we're working on is the dam treaty is up with Canada again, and we're allied with the Colville tribes who are working real hard to get the fish ladder on the Grand Coulee Dam and the Chief Joseph Dams put back into the new treaty with Canada, which we think would be a very worthwhile thing when you look at what it would do economically for people in the Northwest to have that, you know, another 3,000 miles of drainage that's been shut off, opened up to spawning Anadromous fish. We see it as an incredible economic boom to the Northwest all the way down to the California when you consider the salmon fishery in the ocean, how it would help pump that as well.
Right.
But you look at that and compare it to a project like, say, the Keystone Pipeline, which gets a lot of press, and you would think, well, gee, this is major, you know, returning salmon to the Columbia River, you know.
Right.
You would think you don't even read about it in the papers, and most of the leadership that we've contacted on it is pretty much trying to get them behind it, you know, getting this into the new treaty is pretty much noncommittal. They want to see, you know, how everybody else is going to go on it. So it's really turned into a fight just to get this, try to get the supply. But, you know, it seems like something that might be a dream and just kind of out there, but it's actually within reach right now. Actually, while I got everybody on the phone, too, if anybody's out there listening and might be interested in seeing salmon, you know, reintroduced into the upper Columbia, another 3,000 miles of drainage all the way into Montana. In Alberta, then if you write somebody that needs to know, your congressman, anybody, and remind them that that treaty is coming up and we'd like them to be behind it. We'd like to see salmon returned, and we see it as a great work of commonwealth, you know, that would serve us all.
Yeah. Is there anything online, a website or anything that people can go to find out more information? Or?
There is. You could go to Colville. You could Google Colville Tribal Fisheries.
Colville Tribal Dam Fisheries? Okay.
Yep. International Treaty.
Okay.
And you should be able to get some information there, anybody who's interested.
Okay. So back in the days before dams, salmon and steelhead ran all the way up to the upper Columbia that we're talking about?
Yes.
They did. Wow. That's quite a journey.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. Well, actually, the Chief Justice Dam will... Grand Coulee went in first, and that effectively cut off pretty much half of the main vein of the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, yeah.
So, see, when that cut off the Columbia drainage all the way up, cut off the Kootenai drainage all the way into Alberta, the Bow River goes into that. And then all the way, Flathead drainage enters the Ponderay, everything that enters the Ponderay drainage from over into Montana. So, considerable portion.
Now, are you guiding up there? Are you taking
yes, I am.
Clients? How would people find out more about your guide services?
You could go to my guide site at, if you just Google Columbia Trout, you'll get right there. It's on the front page there. You'll also find Upper Columbia Fly Fisher, where there is some information about the dam treaty and the Upper Columbia Native Fish Alliance as well on the same page. So that's Upper Columbia Trout and Upper Columbia Fly Fisher. Those are both my sites. And there's actually some photos, too, on those. And there's a quite a few photos, actually, on my guide site, which is
okay,
Upper Columbia
Trout. Okay, so I'm seeing, Upper Columbia Fly Fisher, ColumbiaTrout.blogspot.com. And what was the other one?
That's Upper Columbia Fly Fisher?
Yeah.
And Upper
is that
Columbia
your guide
Trout.
Site?
My guide site is Upper Columbia Trout.
Oh, Upper Columbia Trout. I see it there. Okay. UCflyfishing.blogspot, right?
That's right.
.com. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Good. Good. All right. Well, thanks for sharing that with us. Okay. A couple other questions about the river itself. Let's see. Thomas Murphy in Redmond, Washington wrote in and he says, what portion of the Columbia is the upper portion? Well, we already talked about that. And what is unique about the section to other sections or link sections like the Kootenai?
That's a good question, because actually when you consider the entire length of the Columbia River, which is the second largest river in the United States, the third largest river, the St. Lawrence and the Mississippi are both bigger. But so it's the main drain of the Pacific Northwest, and the entire river now has been truncated into pretty much a series of reservoirs. There's one reach that's considered wild that still has salmon spawning in the main stem. That would be the Hanford Reach. And then the other reach would be the American Reach, which is in the 19-mile section where we are, which still has an ecosystem. See, now in Lake Roosevelt, you have a lacustrine environment. It's silted out. It's really sterile for all practical purposes, whereas in our 19-mile segment of the American Reach, we have a fully functioning ecosystem with insects and feed and free-spawning trout. So what we have there is basically what we have in the United States is a 19-mile main stem and the Kettle River system and the Spoil River system, which feed into it, that harbor these original strain Red Band rainbow trout. And that's why we think it's so valuable, because it's the only place left that they exist in viable numbers, in self-supporting, sustainable numbers.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Another question he asked is about licensing up in BC. Do you know anything about the licensing requirements up there?
Now, I'm not sure. I think the last time I checked, it was $21 American for a day license.
Okay.
I'm not sure on that. You could check it real quick, but I'm thinking that's what it was the last time I checked.
Okay.
To be frank, I haven't had my passport re-upped since they started to require a passport to go over. I haven't gone over it because I just haven't gone around to get a passport.
Yeah, you didn't need a passport in the past. That's true. Yeah.
Well, you should go up there to go to the laundromat.
Thomas also asked about local campsites near the river up in that section. Is there good places, campgrounds and so forth, to stay in?
Yes, there's. You can camp right there at the city of Northport. They run a free campground right at the boat launch there. You can't tent, but they have trailer parking and hookups there. And if you go right across the river from Northport to Sheep Creek Road, and go on out Sheep Creek Road a few miles, there's a really nice free state campground right there. It's right on Sheep Creek. That's actually pretty good, nice little creek to fish right there, too, as well. And
okay.
That's free camping. And right down the road from me is Upper Columbia Campground, which is a private campground, and they're very, very reasonable. Sometimes they have cabins available, too, and they're right on the river, and right on a pretty good section of the river. I don't know what they're charging right now, but I know the last time I checked with them, I laughed. It was so low. So
okay.
There's also some very, very reasonable cabins in Northport as well, and I think you can get the cabin for about $60 a night or something.
Okay. So Northport, in and around Northport is the place to stay then if you're going to fish that section.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Okay. Joe and D.C. asked, what's the best months to fish the Columbia in that section? What's your season up there?
Well, who can ever say what best is about anything, but I can tell you my favorite month. My favorite month is July. The first 2 weeks in July is my favorite time to fish the river. That's usually when the black quill hatch is peaking. You have peak spotted sedge hatches going off right then. Very good fishing. It still hasn't gotten so hot that the fishing has shrunk down to too late in the evening. Early July is my favorite time. But there's other good times, too. Another one of my favorite times is September through the entire month of September and October for the October Cadus hatch. October Cadus hatch is very important there. Some places it's not. It's one of those places where it is. The fish there eat them really well. They eat the imitations real well. Good fishing on the October Cadus, September and October as well.
Okay. And what kind of Ryan in what's it, Snoqualmie?
Snoqualmie.
Yeah.
Hi, Ryan.
How often do you encounter brown trout in the Upper Columbia? Are there any?
They are. They do exist there. They were introduced into the Kettle River years ago, way back in the 40s. And once in a while, somebody still gets one in the Kettle. But they did make their way down into the Columbia. That's funny. I just caught one this fall on an October Cadus invitation. It blew me away. Actually, I should put a picture of it up on my blog. But it was about a 16-incher. It wasn't a big one. But it was only the second one I've caught since 1973, okay? The other one was
a
6-incher. So, yeah, and I've heard – I had a friend a couple years ago who caught a really nice one, about a 7-pounder down the main stem. It was in the month of March, and he was fishing for pre-spawn trout. And there's a spot down there where the cutthroats spawn in the main stem, and I think the brown had come up out of Lake Roosevelt to feed on the eggs and stuff. It was a nice one. But they do exist there, but they're very rare.
So I forgot to follow up on the seasonal thing. So can you fish the Upper Columbia all year round? Is it?
Yes, it's open year round.
Okay. And for the old guys that like it a little bit warmer, what's the season from like May through September and October? Would that be reasonable?
That's very reasonable. I would say if a person lives, it's a long way to go. One of the reasons that we've been kept a secret, and well, probably the best kept secret in fly fishing, and part of the reason for that is it's almost 200 miles to the nearest interstate. So if you're kind of out there in the back of beyond, it's a long way to go. And for a person that hasn't been there before, if I was going to nail down a time that you would want to plan a trip to really make it worth your while, I would say to wait until right around the 4th of July.
Okay.
You know, sometimes May can be iffy with cold weather, high water. We get hatches in May. We have granum and betis in May. And there's also some squalla. However, it can be rainy in May, and you might have to deal with some cold weather and high water. And that could be very nice. It's hard to say. It's just too iffy.
Yeah.
But if I was going to pick an ideal time to go for the first time and I was just going to wing it on my own, I would suggest going right around the 4th of July.
Okay.
And at that time, you'd probably find pretty good bank fishing pretty much anywhere you go, especially in the evening, right up towards dark the last couple hours of the day.
And many times that time of year down south there, it's too hot to be fishing. So
that's right. That's right.
Good time to go north. So what are the species you target there in the Upper Columbia?
Well, our main fish is, of course, the red bands, and that's the one we catch by far the most. Probably for every 10 red band, we catch one cutthroat, and the cutthroat are native there as well, the West Slope cutthroat. And what we have there is the Kootenai Lake strain, and of course it's dammed between Kootenai Lake and this now, but they're down in there, and they're a shoal spawning strain, and they spawn in the main stem of the river. But like I said, we catch about one of them for every 10 red bands. Once in a while, we'll catch maybe a couple a year, we'll catch a nice brookie. There's some brook trout in there. Usually when you catch one, they're nice big ones, 18, 19 inchers. And once, even more rare, we catch a bull trout. Now, when I first moved up there in 1973, we used to catch a lot of bull trout and some really big ones, too, up to about 30 pounds. However, they don't exist. They built the Keenly Side Dam in 69, and bull trout are highly migratory within their systems, and they spawn up above Arrow Lake. So when they put the dam in, they cut them off from their spawning grounds, and I think in 73, there were still some around, of course, before the river was dammed, but over the years, they pretty much disappeared. Once in a while, we'll catch one. Washington Fish and Game claims that those are fish that have fenestrated through the dam. They don't really think there's any more spawning going on in the stem anymore. So like I said, we do catch a bull trout now, and they are native there. Also, we catch a kokanee every now and then. Kokanee salmon are native there. They've been introduced so much into the lake, they're not sure which are the natives anymore and which are not. They do spawn up the creeks. Once in a while, we'll catch one fly fishing. I've caught several fishing for trout during the sedge hatch on soft tackles. They're usually nice ones when you catch one, 3 or 4 pound kokanee.
Yeah, they're fun. They're
very rare on the fly, but they're there.
Oh, we get them on the fly a lot here in Colorado. And,
nice.
They're a hoot. I mean,
they are.
They're real fighters and runners, and we have a great time with those. So.
There's so few that we really can't target them. You know,
yeah.
I mean, you can go down the lake and troll with gear and stuff and get them, or you could even troll flies too and get them too. And that's something I really want to get around to doing here one of these days. Get into that fishery with flies. But
well, what are the average size red bands you're catching, and what's a trophy fish there?
Now, Upper Columbia red bands average 18, 19 inches. We catch quite a few fish. A session of fishing in the evening, you're going to see a couple in the lower 20s. Every year, we catch one or two that approaches 10 pounds on flies. I consider that a trophy. Of course, I consider anything over 5 pounds or better a trophy. We do catch a lot of 5 pound class fish. That's pretty common.
Okay. And time for me to take a break. Let me take a quick break, and we'll be right back and talk about some flies and techniques here that you're using up there. Okay. Front Range Anglers, full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 31 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging onto their website at frontrangeanglers.com. That's www.frontrangeanglers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Stephen Bird about fly fishing the Upper Columbia. If you'd like to ask Stephen a question, just go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com, and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately. We'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Let's see. Okay, so we have a question coming in on the Internet, which is a good segue into our next section here. Stug McLean up in Calgary, and he says, what sort of rods, lines, and flies do you use for bank fishing the Upper Columbia? Are there differences in what you use on the U.S. and the Canadian stretches of the river? So let's talk about rods and lines and so forth first, and then we'll dig into flies as a separate talk here.
Good question. Well, first I should mention that there's quite a few Scotsmen on the British Columbia side, and there's a cult of those guys up there led by a guy, Bruce Crook. He's a champion fly caster, and these guys are using full-on stay rods up to 15 foot to fish for trout, and you know, they're fishing from the bank, and they're swinging, you know, sink tips and big streamers, and they're catching some fantastic fish, you know, and there's a cult of guys that like that, and I've tried it, but I found that big of a rod is really a little too much. We're trouting after all, but a two-handed rod is a good choice. I'm using a switch rod that rates for 160 to 250 grains, so that throws a 6-weight to 8-weight AFMA trout lines. I think you're right in there with that. Now, if I could only have one rod and I wasn't a two-handed rod, I would say probably the ideal rod would be a 10-foot 6-weight. You'd probably cover everything with that. I like something with a little bit of length there. You have a lot of conflicting currents. If you're fishing from the bank, actually, even if you're fishing from a boat, a lot of times you're fishing over some conflict, so you want to be able to mend. You want to have some length for line control and have as little line off on the water as possible. So a long rod, definitely, for sure, I would prefer. Like I say, a 10-foot 6-weight I would consider ideal. Now, there's going to be times like in the fall and in the spring where you have blue-winged olive hatches going on, a little eddy real close to the bank. You know, they're only 30 feet from the shore. You got to use light line and use a light presentation on them. Then you could break out your 4-weight would be, of course, you know, or a 5-weight would be something you would want to try in a situation like that. So, you know, you are going to run into those situations as well there. But I would say day in, day out, the 6-weight would really cover it all. I would say a 6-weight with a full floating line, you know, able to, with a several 10-foot sink leaders to attach to it, and you'd probably cover everything with that rod.
So sink leaders, is there much call for any sinking lines or intermediate lines?
Absolutely. If you want to throw streamers, definitely want to get them down there. The sink tip is ideal. We're usually using 10-foot heads when we're swinging streamers or wet flies. Usually when there's a hatch on, and of course the fish, you know, showing up top and we're fishing emergers and stuff, we go to full floating lines. But I would say probably day in, day out, when if you're not seeing any surface activity, a guy's actually better off to use a sink tip there and get it down.
Okay. Okay.
Or fish a long leader with a split shot on it.
Okay. How deep are you usually fishing them?
Usually if you're fishing the bank, you know, you're fishing up to 8 feet of water, you know.
Okay.
So generally, anywhere from 2 feet out to 8 feet, I would say generally.
Okay. What are the primary food sources in the river?
Well, we could go through the list of primary food sources now, not necessarily means the most effective hatches to meet. I'd say primary food sources there, of course, sculpin. There's at least six different species of sculpin that live there in the river. There's a lot of sculpin there. You find them in the fish a lot, too. You find a lot of midge larvae in the fish. There's a lot of midges there. So I would say those are probably bread and butter feeds. I've caught fish in February that didn't have anything in them except just midge eggs, just jelly. A couple months out of the year in the dead of winter, that seems like to be what they're feeding on most of the time. But then we have mostly caduses. It's a cadus river. It was actually chemically polluted for quite a few years by the smelter at Cominco and Trail. I was told at one time it had really good salmon fly hatches, and those were probably killed off by the pollution. But now we're starting to see a few. The stoneflies are coming back. They're no longer. It's been about 10 years now since Cominco ceased dumping. And so now we're starting to see the squalas increase. We're starting to see the stoneflies come back. They're usually the most pollution sensitive. We're seeing an increase in the mayflies as well. But mainly caddis. I would say caddis and sculpin and midge are probably the prime food sources. Of course, there's a lot of other stuff on top of that as well. But if you want to know what the prime ones are, I would say it was probably that.
Okay. Yeah, it seems always to be, I had to laugh there for a second when we talk about sculpins and then jumping to midges,
Yeah, really, but it dichotomy there.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah, and everything in between, too. I got a list of all the stuff that's in between here. When the question comes up, I'll shoot that one off to you, too.
Yeah, well, I think it's kind of funny because, if I were a fish, man, after sipping on midges all day long, a sculpin, it'd really feel good in the gullet there, One bite and I'm full,
Well, you just grab those opportunistically there as you're sipping.
Yeah. So they're probably harder to catch than midges for sure.
Well, there's a certain time of year, actually the sculpins spawn in the spring and they get real active. A lot of times when they're not active, they're kind of hard, especially in that rubble kind of bottom. It makes it hard for the trout to get at them.
Yeah.
And actually, that's the case for a lot of the nymphs as well. But a lot of it will depend on the geology of the stream. But in this, when they get sexy, when they get in the mood for spawning, they get real active and they move around and they take chances. Yeah, that's when the trout really start getting on them. So they're a really good invitation to use in the early spring, late winter, and all the way through the early spring until the hatches start. You really can't go wrong with a sculpin invitation of some sort.
Yeah. So, one of the questions was the hatches on the river, and you said there's a lot of insect activity up there. Can you kind of walk us through the hatch season and what you might find from spring to fall there?
Sure. Well, for one thing, like I said before, when there's no hatches apparent, the streamers and wet flies are getting colorful ones too. Combinations of red, gold, copper, and yellow are triggers there. But when the hatches are happening, I'm usually out down there throwing streamers in March or late February, and I'll run up against the little winter stoneflies. I'm usually unprepared when I do come across them. They're sporadic. You can't count on them, but they do get fish up and feeding. So usually in the winter, the first thing you're going to see is the little winter stoneflies. A little later on, you're going to start seeing some blue-winged olives in March, warmer days in March, warm overcast days. The squalls will start to show up about then. April, about the middle of April, about time trout season opens, you start to see some granums. They get really going pretty good through May and the early part of June. Through June, beginning about the 1st of June, we start to see a lot of betas, little red quill, pale morning duns, March browns at that time as well in May. Coming up into June, the granum starts to give way to spotted sedge. They're the same size. The adults are about a number 16, the nymphs are 14. same imitations work on them. Spotted sedge are way more prolific. Granums tend to hatch real close to the bank. You don't catch very many fish. They give you a little bit of a chance on the dry fly. You don't catch a lot on the pupa or on the spotted sedge. The little soft tacker pupas just kill on them. And that starts about the middle of June and rolls until the end of August, the spotted sedge. So they're a nightly, they're a daily occurrence. They're something we're fishing over through the whole summer. About the end of May, maybe a few green drakes. We don't get heavy green drake hatches there. They're more a presence. The flies start to work. So, okay, once in a while you'll see one, but the fish know they're around, so the green drake patterns start to work around the early part of June. Later on, through the month of June, the spotted sedges are king. About the 4th of July, the black quills show up. Now, this is our big drake hatch, the black quill, Leptophlebia. Not a very important hatch in very many places, except a few places in the upper Columbia drainage, the flathead drainage, I'm told. It's a big mayfly. The adults are, 8 down to 12. They vary a little bit, seem as big as 8. They're real. They got a characteristic charcoal black wing. They're easy to recognize. They're mahogany color with a striking yellow banding through the abdomen segments. They're real easy to recognize. But that's our reliable drake hatch. Like I say, they start about the 4th of July, and they usually peak about the 2nd or 3rd week of July, and the imitations on them will continue working up through till the end of August almost. Just about in there somewhere. And that's our most important mayfly hatch of the year. Usually as they start to die down, we start to get pretty good little black caddis hatches. Also some great gray spotted sedge. They look like the spotted sedge, only they're quite a bit bigger. They're about a number 10. They come on right before the October caddis. About the end of August, you'll start to see a few October caddis. Right around the first week in September, you start to see them in earnest. And like I say, they roll pretty heavy through the month of September and October. And that's then usually about when they wrap up there at the end of October, there's a little bit of midge fishing still. There's going to be sporadic midge hatches through the whole season. They're sporadic on the river. You might run into one somewhere and the fish are up on them, whereas, you know, a mile up river, it's a different story. So, but they're pretty good size. They have the big, good size buffalo midges. They're about a number 18, so it's a pretty good size midge to carry. And that's it for the major hatches. There's other stuff too mixed in, but there's not, these are the ones that I just listed are the ones that, that are really worthwhile to meet.
Yeah. And Thomas in Redmond, Washington, did ask about streamers or wets. And maybe you can just talk about streamers, and then we can start talking about soft tackle, which I know you're partial to.
That's good. I'd like to talk about streamers and wets, actually.
Yeah.
A lot of guys don't. By wets, when I'm referring to wets here, I'm talking about winged wets, like hair wing wets, like we might use on the coast for steelhead or sea run cutthroat. Colorado guys still use them too, I think, the tube style ones. But those work really good on the river, and I actually catch more fish on number 8 wet flies, fanciful wet flies, than I do on the larger streamers. Now, usually if I'm going to fish a streamer, I'll fish a sculpin imitation because they're going to hit it. They're going to eat it. But day in, day out, I catch more fish, like I say, on the smaller. If I'm going to fish in a wet attractor, I'll go with the wet fly over the bigger streamer. They just seem to they like that size better. Like I say, that number 8 is a real good one, a real good wet fly there. And it's kind of unique in that, it's, you know, it's big water, and it's kind of like steelhead fishing. In fact, our fish are steelhead. If they still had access to the ocean, they would go there. But
yeah.
So it's a lot like steelhead fishing, and they're a lot like steelhead in their habits and what they like to eat, too. And they really like to eat air wing wet flies.
I noticed you had some of those, your own designs on your blog.
Right, I do have some. The ones actually I have, I don't post any experimental stuff on there. The only ones I post on there are the ones that I've actually tried and work. Actually, what's posted on there are the flies that I use. Mm-hmm. So if you want to get an idea, actually, I've just recently posted quite a few of the hairwing wet flies. And
right.
If you want to get an idea about the kind of flies I'm talking about there, that's, you might want to check those out. But it's always good streamer fishing in the morning, early in the morning, all through the year. You know, a guy, anytime that that you think fish might hit a lure, a spoon or a spinner, they'll hit a presented streamer.
Right.
So there's plenty of opportunity to fish streamers.
Okay. Steve DeBlois, or DeBlois in Nashville, wrote in and he said, what do you find to be the most consistent soft hackle pattern on the Upper Columbia? He says, do your techniques work on rivers in the area such as the Colville or Quarter Lane?
All right. Well, I guess if they were going to choose the most consistent soft tackle, I would choose a partridge and hare's ear, a simple partridge and hare's ear, gold ribbed, no tail. That's consistent. Or a simple partridge and peacock, or a partridge and peacock, brown partridge and just a peacock body, very simple. Those two simple flies right there, you will catch fish. Now the Colville River and the Coeur d'Alene River, you're talking about two entirely different kinds of waters there. The Colville River is a real low graduate meadow stream, real slow flow, silt bottom. It flows through farmland, whereas the Coeur d'Alene is a freestone. However, I have fished them both, and I've fished them both with soft tackle flies too. Now there's some big browns in the Colville. Now usually when I fish there, I'll fish the muddler, but you know, you might run into a situation there though on the Colville where you'll find some small mayflies hatching and fish up and feeding on them. And I would say in a situation like that, you know, go down to a light leader and a little tiny soft tackle fly, you know, and put it on them. And you know, it's all about the presentation. And so if you got the right size fly, I think it's more important the size and the silhouette and the presentation. So yeah, you're gonna find situations on the Colville where you could deliver that soft tackle and catch fish. Same thing on the Coeur d'Alene, you know, which might want a little bit different presentation, but you could still, you know, get a good natural drift there with your soft tackle fly. Sure, you're gonna catch some fish. I've caught them there actually in the Coeur d'Alene too. So. Yeah. As far as the techniques go, I use whatever technique the particular run I walk up to calls for. You know, it's like I don't go to a place, you know, with a technique that I'm going to fish in mind. It's each piece of water that you fish actually dictates a different approach or different presentation. So pretty much I just deliver my fly however I need to, you know, to,
right,
to fish that particular run.
Well, yeah,
the soft tackles, I have good luck with them everywhere, though. Answer your question on that one.
Let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back and talk more about wet flies and soft tackles and so forth. Have you ever dreamed about the classic actions of bamboo fly rods? Did you know that it's possible for you to make your own bamboo fly rods? With the help of Power Fibers Online Magazine, you can do just that. Power Fibers is a magazine dedicated to making bamboo fly rods and telling the stories about bamboo through the ages. From rod-making techniques to stories about fishing bamboo rods to rod-maker profiles to classic papers, Power Fibers has it all. Visit their website at www.powerfibers.com. That's www.powerfibers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Stephen Bird about fly fishing the Upper Columbia. If you'd like to ask Stephen a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, we did have a question about from John Zenovar in Kalamazoo, Michigan. He says, aside from Sylvester Neems, who I consider to be the all-time authority on soft tackle flies, what other authors or tires do you recommend reading about?
I would say if you're really interested and off-tackle approach, go back and read George Skew's Minor Tactics of the English Chalk Stream. That's a good place to start. And then, of course, before Neems, definitely you want to go read the Art of the Wet Fly by James Weisenring and Pete Heide. I also highly recommend Nymph Fishing for Larger Trout by Charles Brooks, who is very innovative. Brooks is a very innovative tire. He uses a lot of the soft tackle approach, which actually is natural materials, motion, obfuscation, okay? He builds those principles into his flies. So he uses a lot of the principles that Weisenring and Heide are talking about in Art of the Wet Fly to make some very innovative, very effective flies. So I would suggest reading Charles Brooks to get another angle on the approach. And he's kind of like the father of the modern approach, too. Nymph pretty much was, although he was a really good writer, and he was really popularized. He did a lot to popularize the fly. He was more of a cheerleader than an innovator. Brooks was an innovator, so was Weisenring and Heide. A guy right now that's got a couple books out, Alan McGee, is very good, modern soft tackles. Dave Hughes has done one or two very good books. One book that I know of that I read that was very good. If you really want to get on top of it, go online, check out Flimp Forum, flimpforum.com. It's a site totally devoted to soft tackle flies. Pete Heide's son hangs out there. They have a library of archived material on soft tackle flies that goes all the way back to Dame Julianne Bernard's, and all the British stuff is archived there. You would be amazed what's there beyond Sylvester Neame's. And also, you can check out the fly department there. You want to see what the really innovative, probably, I think the guys that hang out there are probably the best fly tires in the world today. But you really want to check out really great soft tackle flies and innovations that are going down in the approach, check out the Flimp Forum. That'd be flimpforum.com. That's actually the home of the Brotherhood of the Flint as well, which has been around for quite a while.
And another source, John, would be in our archive. We did a couple of shows, one with Davey Wanton, who's a big wet fly guy down in on the White
River
in Arkansas, and also did a show with Bill Edrington on fishing wet flies, old school, still works. So go in the archive and just type in wet fly, and you'll come up with a couple of shows there that'll introduce you more into techniques and so forth there as well.
Very good. If I could interrupt for a minute on that one and add to that, Roger, you know, I meet a lot of guys guiding. They show up, and the first thing they want to do, and all they've I meet guys now that all they've ever done since they started fly fishing is fish a bobber and a beadhead. They've never learned any other techniques, and that's the way they want to fish, or they think they have to fish everywhere they go. It's not that great of an approach, actually, on the Upper Columbia. Yeah, there's times it works, but it's not the best. And some guys are just – so I think it's really what these guys are teaching, like Davey Wotan and the other wet fly guys. They're teaching regular fly fishing like we used to do it, you know, and like our dads and our granddads did. And it's actually basic fly fishing. It's a basic approach to fly fishing. If somebody was going to take the bobber away from you, that's the way you'd have to fish. So that's really good these guys are writing, and it's getting more popular too as people are starting to learn how effective it is, and really, you know, fish always change their moods. There's always going to be a presentation that they want over another.
Yeah. You know,
and the bobber and beadhead ain't always going to be it.
Yeah, there you go. Well, one more question about fly tying, and then let's talk about some strategies and tactics that you find that work for you best. Alan in California wrote in, and he wants to know about, in today's world with so many different types of fly tying material, have you noticed a difference in takes between natural and artificial material?
By take, does he mean when a fish takes the fly?
Yeah.
Good question. But I have to say, honestly, I have not noticed the difference in the take. Now, I guess if you were fishing a lot of dry flies or maybe just dry flies and you're using a lot of, trying back and forth, you might notice a difference in the take. But no, I'm not. I'd be interested to know if anybody else was, though.
Yeah, okay. So let's talk then about strategies and tactics that you find productive on the Columbia? You know, if you're out riding some of the day and you want to do something other than bobber beanhead fishing, where do you take them?
Excuse me, something happened on the phone right there, Roger. If you could run that question by me again.
Oh, sure. I said, if you're going to take somebody out guiding up on the Upper Columbia, and you want to teach them some new strategies and techniques other than bobber and beadhead fishing, where would you take them? What would you teach them? How would you direct them?
Well, I would take them to where it was happening, for one thing, and of course I would assess the person's needs, you know, size up what they needed to learn. Of course, it would depend on what we were doing that day, too. So I would assess the individual, their gear, make sure they had the right gear. You know, if usually I wait. I had a guy come from, I called him the absent-minded professor. He was great. This guy had, he's an older man that just recently started fly fishing. He was a professor. He was a professor of geology and also had several doctorates, but he'd gone to study in New Zealand for a few years. And while he was over there, he'd taken up fly fishing, and he liked it. He had just started. He'd been 3 years over there, and he fished while he was over there. So he decided he wanted to come fishing with me, and he found me and hired me, and he came up. And first thing he told me was he was real shy. All he wanted to do was camp. He loved camping, and he just went on the river, and all he wanted to do was go down and fish on the bank by himself. He insisted he didn't want any help. He insisted he wanted to use his flies that he brought with him from New Zealand. So I wanted to look at the flies. Let me see the flies. I look at them, I go, oh, man, it was like the weirdest things you ever seen. I got all these weirdo flies, right? So, like, I didn't say anything. I thought, okay, this is what he wants to do. He's adamant. I'm going to let him do it. I'm not going to say a word. I'm just going to point him to the river. Guy went down there, I went down there with him, he could barely flop it out there 20 feet. I went, oh man. So I gave him a little bit of instruction on the casting and stuff, and then I let him go. He wanted to be left alone. Heck, sure enough, he comes back a few hours later, and I said, well, did you do any good? He says, I caught a couple real nice ones. I said, oh, hey, good for you. I said, where'd you catch mine? He shows me this thing, it looks like a beetle on acid, rubber stuff sticking out. I'm like, oh, all right, pretty good. That's great. Heck, he stayed there for 10 days, and every day he didn't want to be guided. Every day he went down there, he'd catch a few fish, half a dozen fish. One day he wanted one for the fire, for the barbecue. And I said, well, okay, bring one back for the barbecue. He came back, he had a 19-inch brook trout. I said, man, you killed that brook trout. I didn't know what it was. I said, oh, it's okay, they're not made, we'll pick it. But this guy did fine, you know, and he just wanted to fish his way with his flies. And I don't tell people how they fish. If they ask me, you know, I mean, I'll direct them. I'll try to herd them in the right direction. But usually I don't like to come off, you know, as didactic and start rearranging the way people fish. Usually I'll wait to see if they're going to do any good. If I see them striking out, then I'll start to, you know, I'll start to wave on them.
So what,
like
you know,
I said,
how do you,
that's what they need, what the situation calls for.
Yes. So what are some of the tactics that you use? I mean, let's talk about presenting soft tackle flies and what your approach is to that.
Right. Well, my approach on the Columbia is a downstream approach. The river begs a downstream approach. It really does. With a fast current, most of the fish along the edge are concentrated on the seam water. You have these small rocky points, and in some cases larger points, that jut into the river, and they all form a little seam off their tip, and that's where the fish are concentrated, right along those seams. So what you want to do is, if you're fishing from the bank, is basically what I'm doing is I'm fishing the swing. Now, that's the basic way that I'll fish the river. There's times where I will do an upstream approach, you know, if I see that's what's calling for, if there's some fish there that I want to get it in front of them. But generally, if you're just fishing the water, I'll go for a downstream approach. I'll quarter across and up slightly, you know, to get my fly sinking as it goes down, keeping contact with it all the way down. I'm following it with my rod tip and just stripping just enough to keep contact with it as it goes down, possibly mending if I need to. and then just keep in contact all the way down through the swing. Now, when it starts to approach down the drift, when it starts to approach the swing at the end of the drift, sometimes I'll feed a little bit of line, slow it down. I'll let a little line slip through my fingers, and as I do that, I'll stop it. That'll make the fly hitch as it's starting to approach the end of the swing. And then when it starts to get in there, if I see it's still in a good area where when it gets to the end of the swing, I'll do a rising wing lift. I'll let it stop. I'll raise my rod slightly, let it bring it up, and then I'll drop my rod tip back down to the water again, let my fly drop back. I might do that several times. It's what we call the dangle. It's kind of against what we were taught as kids about fishing and getting a drag-free drift, but actually it's very effective. And so I'll fish that dangle that there at the end of the swing if the fly's in good water, and then I'll just pick up, take a couple steps downstream, repeat the same thing over and over again. Just quarter, drift, swing, dangle, strip, step, recast. Okay, that's the basic swing and dangle. That's the basic, whether I'm fishing a soft tackle or a streamer or a wet fly, that's the basic way I'll go at it from the bank. Now, if I'm in a spot, like an eddy spot or something, those places like what we call the grottos, where you have conflicting currents coming together and fish concentrated in confluence or bowl-like structure, you know, then you just approach them however you need to, you know, to get it drifting, you know, in front of them, you know, on their nose. You might only get a short drift, but basically it's based, the basic swing and dangle is really a very, very good presentation there.
I use that wet fly. I use that dangle approach quite often when my line's all tangled up and I got 30 feet
of line. Then one
out.
Nails it while you're right untangling, right?
Yeah.
I think that's how it got started, Roger. You know, now it's actually a secret technique that we employ.
Yeah, it's kind of like, not now. I'm trying to get my line untangled. I can't even pull you in because, you know, my line's all screwed up. So, yeah, it always...
Well, the really great thing about that, about fishing the swing like that, is when a trout hits it, man, you really get nailed. I mean, there's no question. You know, there's no setting the hook. Except, unlike with a bobber and beadhead, you know, it's, you know, where they just pick it up, you know, it's very tender. You know, you get slammed on the swing, and you really get slammed on the dangle.
Yeah, that's
it's
nice.
very exciting way to fish.
Yeah. So, and then your other techniques about, you know, just standard nymph fishing. You said that, you know, what you call a bobber or strike indicator, and nymph fishing is all not
we
that
do sometimes.
Or,
a lot of times. Oh, go ahead.
No, is it all, you said it wasn't that effective on the Columbia?
Well, I said it can be at times. It can be at times, but day in, day out, as a technique, the swing and dangle is more effective.
Oh,
but
okay.
Now there's times like during the dray catch when we, for a period, we fish a great big hairwing dry fly version of the black quill, and we'll fish, oh, maybe 12 inches of leader tied to the bend of the hook with a little nymph version of it, a little soft tackle, just a little brown soft tackle nymph, about a number 12 underneath that to fish the nymph version of it. And that's a really effective rig during that period, during that drake period. They might take the dry. They might take that nymph you have dangling under it.
Right.
Or sometimes we'll dangle a soft tackle sedge under that. So that is, I prefer fishing the big dry to the bobber, though, when I do that.
Yeah. The soft tackle dropper on that is that to more simulate a rising nymph or a emerger kind of thing?
That's right. Actually, hairwing dry is very good there, too. Actually, if somebody's into old-fashioned flies, they'd really like the upper Columbia because the trout there really have a taste for that kind of thing. They like soft tackles. They like hairwings. The hairwing drakes work really great. Of course, the water's rough, so it's, you know, it helps to have the flotation of a fly like that there. But they really do work good. They really like the hairwings and the old-fashioned type flies.
The one of the questions that came in here on the internet was from Phil in California, and He said he wants to, if he wants to catch a 10-pound rainbow or bigger in the Upper Columbia River, what advice would you give him about where, when, and how to go about it? I guess.
Go often.
We all want to know the answer to this one. So.
Go often. I've caught one 10-pounder in the last 5 years.
Well, you're not the guy to ask that.
Myself. I caught that on a yellow jacket tri fly. So I catch one or two 8-pounders every year. A 10-pounder. Now, if you wanted to fish gear, now they get up to the guide up in Canada. They got a 35-pound Kamloops there a few years ago. So they just get big. So I mean, if you wanted a 10-pounder and he went out there and trolled the polos and gear and stuff long enough, he'd probably get one. But if you want to get one on the fly, I think a guy would have to put a lot of time in for a 10-pounder. I think if you fish the kind, we were just talking about that this summer, you know, fishing for that. But the thing is, you get, you know, you, when you start to go just for the big fish like that and you go for the gear required, you know, big streamers or whatever, something that looks like a 6-inch long feet mouth sucker or whatever, you know, you really got to put a lot of time in there fishing that. And it's not a place that I wouldn't suggest going there, look at one trip, few days, whatever, looking for a 10-pounder because you might be disappointed.
Yeah.
You'd have to put some time in for your 10-pounder.
You're right. I was fishing up in Idaho, and we were just trying to put the drift boat in the water, and it was just below diversion dam thing, and there was some young kid there, and he had some big spoon on. He threw that down the bottom of the diversion dam, of course, and just, you know, kind of raked the bottom with that thing and came out with, you know, like about a 6-pound fish. And I'm going, geez. Of course, I worked the whole rest of the day and was lucky to catch, you know.
Well, that's right.
But you're right.
I got to tell you, the biggest trout I ever caught out of the Upper Columbia was a 17-pounder that I caught on a red and white Eppinger Daredevil. So
yeah.
If you want to go with a spoon, there's one that I know works. So.
So, you know, when you can get down deep with those things and stay down deep, it makes all the difference in the world. And kind of
well, that's the thing. You know, and that's the thing with the sink tip lines, too, really, with the streamers and stuff. It makes such a difference. If you're delivering that thing down where they are, you know, if you want it tickling over the bottom.
Yeah.
You know, that's where you're going to catch them. That's why I carry generally two sink tips, one a quick one and one a medium one, quick sinking. I make them out of old sinking lines. But and usually I'm using that quick sink one, you know, and that works just right. That's 10 feet of I think it was 6 inches per second. It's not the fastest one. 10 feet is 6 inches per second, and that keeps my rig tickling right over the bottom on the Upper Columbia.
Yeah. One more question, then we'll have to call it quits here. Steve wrote in on the Internet from Moscow, Idaho. He says he was asking about boat access on the American region. I know you said that might not be the best approach, but are there boat ramps?
Yes,
there's
a boat launch at Northport. Right there at downtown Northport, the city park, you can launch your boat right there.
What about closer to the border?
There's no boat launching up there. You'd have to launch in Northport and drive up the river.
Oh, with a motor kind of thing. Yeah, it's a big enough river to do that. I was thinking drift boat.
Yep.
But there's
no drift boat put in on the upper part. There was actually right there at the border crossing, but since the terrorism scare, they don't let us use anymore.
Oh, okay. All right, well, time to wrap it up here. Stick with me, though, here, Stephen, because we're going to give away a few gifts, including your book tonight, and I want you to help me out with that. But we'll close it off here, and we'll be giving away that one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal as well. Stephen's book, Upper Columbia Fly Fisher. So hang tight, folks, and we'll do that in just a few moments. Family Ties, that's T-Y-E-S. Family Ties is an organization which uses a shared interest in fly fishing and fly tying to enhance youth development and family relationships. They utilize resources in schools, communities, and businesses, and they invite your participation. Go to their website, www.familytyes.com, and visit their site there. Family Ties, where every fish is a trophy and every kid is a hero. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage under the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Now it's time to give away a few prizes. The winners for our drawings are randomly selected from this show's registration database. If you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late, but make sure you do so for the next show, and you don't want to miss out on some of these great prizes we have to give away. Now, if you are the lucky winner, we'll contact you after the show to provide you with information on how to receive your prize. So first, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And to learn more about the Federation, go to fedflyfishers.org, and you'll find a lot of information on that organization. They are an international organization, saltwater, freshwater, warm water, and they do a lot in the area of conservation. So hold on just a second. I'm going to get my computer to do the random drawing. Hold on. Okay, looks like our first winner for the Federation membership is Luke McKee, and he's from Washington State. So, Luke, thanks for tuning in tonight, and congratulations on winning that one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And now we'll do the drawing for the one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, courtesy of Amato Books. And let's see who that's going to be here. Zach Funkhauser in Idaho. So Zach Funkhauser. So congratulations, Zach. It sounds like we've got some people listening from the Northwest here tonight, which is great.
My homies.
Your homies? Yeah. Do you know any of these guys?
No, I sure don't.
Okay, okay.
Not by name anyway. I might know if I've seen them.
Yeah, yeah. So great, great. Congratulations to both of you. But let's work out who's going to get Steve's book tonight. And clear my queue. Okay. So we'll make this a pretty easy. What? When Stephen does his quarter stream down river cast, and he ends the cast with a what? What does he end the cast with? Okay, I'm checking my queue here to see if we've got a winner here. And still checking here. Come on, guys. What does he end the cast with? And we have an answer here. First answer is a dangle. Would that be right, Stephen?
The dangle.
So, Phil in California. Phil's
you got a dangling man there.
Yeah, Phil's a long-time listener. He's been just about on every show, if not all of them, I think. So, Phil, congratulations. Send me your mailing address so we can get the book sent out to you, and you can do it in that same text box that you submitted your answer in, or you can send it to info@askaboutflyfishing.com, and we'll get that book sent out to you from Amato. So thanks for playing, Phil, and thanks for getting that right. You were the first one and the correct answer, so the famous dangle. Okay, so, hey, Stephen, we really appreciate you being on the show tonight. It was a pleasure to talk to you and learn about the Upper Columbia. Place sounds like I need to visit at some time in my life. Put it on the bucket list, right?
I would do that.
Yeah.
A lot of fun.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thanks for joining us tonight and taking your time. Hopefully, all of you have found our archive. We talked about it tonight. Lots of shows. We've got a couple in there on wet flies, so check that out as well. If you are looking for the archive, it's at the bottom of every page on our website. We've got over 190 shows there in the archive now, from trout to tarpon to different rivers and lakes and so forth. So check it all out. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised. Our next broadcast, we're going to try to be on December 17th, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. We're still waiting for confirmation on our guest for that show, so I can't announce it yet, but I will be sending out emails so you know what's happening. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Platte River Fly Shop, Front Range Anglers, Housatonic River Outfitters, and Power Fibers Online Magazine for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, and we'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.